Welcome to the audio podcast of Taking Charge. This is adapted from Chapter 2 of William Badke's book, Research Strategies, Finding Your Way Through the Information Fog, available in the NJIT Library. This chapter is read by Galen Faison, Kate Wiggins, and Heather Dalal.
You may be saying to yourself, I've never been good at this research thing. In fact, I don't think I have a good research project in me. My response is, of course you don't. A good research project is out there, not inside you. What you have to do is get out there, find the data, work with it, and use it to make a difference. At this point, be aware that we are talking about a certain kind of research here. Not the social scientific or scientific research that involves experiments, but informational research, such as you will find in the humanities or in literature reviews, in the social sciences and sciences. This kind of research is all about data and information, its discovery and use. Now, before you run off to a dark alley frequented by black market sellers of data, let me offer you a safer alternative. What follows is a list of basic things that you need to have working for you in order to turn your anxiety into a brilliant project, leading to an excellent product.
1. You need an intense desire to do a brilliant project, not just an average one. By definition, most people can do an average project.
2. You need to take your time and plan your research as a strategy, rather than a mad dash through libraries and databases. Google can provide you with a lot of resources, but Google results have a nasty tendency to be academically weak. Libraries know when you have reached the panic stage. The books close ranks and refuse to be found. Titles in the catalog trade places so that you can't locate them. The smell of the musty books renders you numb and silly. Databases can do even worse things to you. Don't ask.
Don't panic. Take it easy. Work out a plan and show that data who's in charge here. 3. You need to become a friend to structure. If you're the kind of person who might follow your schedule if you could remember where you put it, or someone who views a library overdue fine as a reasonable price to pay for never having to think about a due date, research is going to be a battle for you. Structure and organization, from the beginning of the process all the way to its triumphant end, is crucial, no matter how much pain it will cost you to change your ways.
4. You need to develop lateral thinking. Lateral thinking is akin to what happens in a football game. The quarterback has no openings at all. If he runs with the ball, he'll be flattened. So instead of moving forward, he throws the ball sideways to another player who can move it forward. These are the steps. Recognize that your advance along one line is blocked. Abandon your approach and look for another that is completely different. And run with your new approach and make it work, or try yet another.
It's like the old story of the truck that got stuck in the highway underpass. No towing vehicle of any kind can get it out, and so the workers were left with the option of dismantling an expensive truck or tearing down an even more expensive underpass. That is, until the light bulb went on and some bright lateral thinker suggested letting the air out of the truck's tires to lower it. Lateral thinking works beyond the obvious in the realm of the creative. Nurture this gift of lateral thinking within you. It will help greatly in that moment when all your cherished strategies have failed you and you still don't have the information you need. Here's an example. Suppose you were doing research on the legal trial of Galileo and discovered that every book within the text of the verdicts against him was already signed out. Rather than thinking the library has let you down and you are doomed to wander the streets as a pathetic warning to others, think beyond the library, a lateral, and check to see if someone has posted the verdict transcripts on the internet. That's the sort of thinking that can save you from the disaster which often lurks, ready to bite the unsuspecting.
Wrestling with a topic. You may hear students say, I have to write a research paper on the California Gold Rush. Right now, I don't know much about it, so I better get into Wikipedia, then find 2 or 3 books. Hopefully, it's not a lot of work to pull everything together, but I hope I have enough for 10 pages. Seems to me that it shouldn't take that many words to explain what happened. As an educator, I like to take the student to the side and explain a few things myself. Do you know how many glaring errors I found in that one brief statement? The most serious is that our California Gold Rush research writing paper student is not going to end up with a research paper, because reading up on a topic and explaining it is not research.
What, you say? Not research?
The student has a topic. California Gold Rush. Finds some stuff on it and writes it up. If that's not research, what is? Don't tell me that's not research. All right, I won't. If I were a member of the Tough Love School of Thought, I would say something like this to you. Go ahead and write your paper and retell the story of the California Gold Rush, a story your professor has read 1,000 times in 1,000 papers, just like yours. And then turn it in and wait for your professor to read the paper and give you the usual dreary grade. Obviously, you don't like your professor anyway, and that's why you keep doing this to him or her. Professors are no strangers to the kinds of boredom you inflict on them. In fact, they're quite used to the tedious task of grading your essays. You bore the professor, and the professor pays you back by giving you a C. Any illusion that you actually did research will be dead by the time you get the essay back. Not ever wanting to be as harsh as that, at least without providing some help, let me ask instead, what is good and useful research if it's not what you've been doing? To answer, let's begin by looking at what is not.
Elements of inadequate research. Inadequate research assumes that the task is merely to gather data and synthesize it, the data as goal philosophy. Thus, the typical student research project involves amassing data, reading and absorbing it, then regurgitating it back onto a fresh piece of paper. The purpose of the project is simply to study up on something and then explain it using other people's writings as a guide.
Inadequate research deals in generalities and surveys. It loves a superficial look at a big topic, and it abhors depth and analysis.
Inadequate research asks no analytical questions and makes no pretense of advancing knowledge. It's happy just to report on what has already been done, to summarize the past.
Inadequate research is so boring that you should be surprised if it ever gets completed, let alone forced upon the long-suffering professor.
The key to great research. What's the point of doing research, then? A flip response might be that a professor or employer told you to do a project and you're just following orders, but that's not the answer I'm looking for. You should recognize first that there is a big difference between seeing data as a goal and data as a tool. What do I mean? Consider these two models. Data as goal. Find out everything you can about a topic, explain what you've learned. Data as tool. Find out the basics about your topic. Identify a problem or issue related to that topic. Use the data you collect as a tool to try to solve the problem or issue. Consider the California Gold Rush as an example. Data as goal. Find out what you can about the California Gold Rush's main events. Explain those main events. Data as tool. Read some basic data on the California Gold Rush. Discover an issue, for example, the role of the California Gold Rush-related Act for the Government and Protection of Indians in destroying much of the native Indian population during the Gold Rush. Ask a question like this one. Was the goal of the Act for the Government and Protection of Indians to protect native populations or to provide workers for the California Gold Rush? You may find this approach a bit strange. Not only does data as tool ask you not to cover the whole topic, aren't you supposed to cover the whole topic? But it focuses on an issue or controversy rather than merely explaining what you can find out about the topic in general. Its purpose is analysis and problem solving. But consider the alternative. You set a goal of retelling the California Gold Rush story, then go through the horror of finding a bunch of sources, reading them, deciding what details to synthesize, snagging some good quotes, and making sure you cite your sources properly. After all that, you'll know you'll only get a mediocre grade unless you do something brilliant. But you don't have the time, and what is brilliant in a research paper anyway? There seems to be no clear path to going from mediocre to an A when all you're doing is reporting on what you read. No wonder why students seem to hate the research papers so much. Have you ever had a professor tell you that he or she expects critical thinking in your paper? If so, you have probably wondered how critical thinking works in research. The approach I'm suggesting in this book should take you a long way in that direction, but first we need to address a couple of questions. Does the professor actually expect you to write on the whole topic? In a few cases, the answer will be yes, and you'll have to do what the professor requires. But in most situations, professors expect you to narrow down by choosing only one aspect of the larger topic. Does the professor want description, data as goal, or analysis, data as tool? Once again, a few may merely want a summary of what you studied, but most, especially those who refer to critical thinking, want you to address a problem using data as a means to analyze the issues and come up with some kind of solution. If you are at all in doubt, contact your professor and explain to him or her what you want to do. Getting shot down before you start isn't all that painful, and at least you'll know for sure what's expected. Not checking in advance may have you getting one of those faded comments, "This fails to meet the goals of the assignment," along with a low grade. Chances are, if you check, the professor will give you a green light and a well done. The key to genuine research is a good question that addresses a problem calling for analysis. Without posing a question, nothing you are doing can be called research. Just as your study of the California Gold Rush led to discovery of the issue of the Act for the Government and Protection of Indians, so the following question crystallizes that issue. What was the purpose of the Act for the Government and Protection of Indians? To protect native populations or to provide workers for the California Gold Rush? What constitutes a good question? Here the situation becomes more complex because you need to begin rethinking the whole research process. Later in this chapter, we will consider the actual strategies involved in getting a topic ready for research. But for now, let's interface with some basic principles. The first of these is that most any research project presented to you needs some work before it is viable enough to use. Assume, unless you know otherwise, that the topic is probably too broad to be workable short of writing a book on it. A topic like the California Gold Rush, or abortion, or economic conditions in Russia today is not likely to inspire depth of analysis because you don't have space in 10 or 20 pages to deal with anything but the superficial. You are going to have to focus on a more narrow aspect of the topic so that you can deal with it in depth. Consider a bathtub with a gallon of water in it as opposed to a bathroom sink with a gallon of water in it. Which is deeper? The sink, because the borders are narrower. The same principle works in a research project. The narrower your focus, the more chance you have of getting some depth into your project. Assume, second, that you are going to have to develop a sound working knowledge of the topic before you're going to know what to do with it. I see a lot of students floundering for hours at the beginning of a project because they really don't understand the basics of the subject matter they are dealing with. Third, and I repeat this for a reason, assume that you may have to negotiate with the professor who gave you the project. You need to know that what you propose is actually going to fly with the person ultimately responsible for your fate. But cheer up. Professors are generally thrilled by any tiny evidence of creativity in their students. Go to your professor and ask politely, "Would you mind if I pursued this issue raised by the California Gold Rush? It looks really interesting." Your professor's heart will turn to mush, and he or she will say quietly, "Yes, all right," while inside she or he is shouting, "A new approach! I'm getting a new approach!" Caution. Don't ever say, "May I write on the Yukon Gold Rush instead?" This signals the professor that you don't like the topic you are offered, and you most certainly will end up having to write on it anyway.
A model for research. What, then, is research all about? Well, you begin with a question. You collect data. You synthesize it. And put it together in some coherent form. You analyze it in the light of the question, figuring out how each piece of data could be used to answer the question. The analysis turns data into information. Then you come up with the conclusions and recommendations. See, the key to the whole thing is that you need to move beyond merely gathering data, reorganizing it, and reporting on what you read. When a question is injected into the mix, the data becomes more than an end in itself and turns into the raw material needed to answer the question. The result is analysis that turns data into information that then can be used to reach an answer. Looks easy, doesn't it? Well, maybe it doesn't just yet, but we are about to embark on a journey that will make things much clearer.
Getting started in research. Getting a working knowledge through reference sources. Before you go off in all directions at once, get a grip on yourself. As a librarian, I see the same painful experience repeated day after day, students walking uneasily into our book stacks area, then stopping, frozen to the ground. I know what's buzzing through their battered minds. I'm here. I'm actually here in the library, about to start researching my topic, and I don't have a clue what to do. Time has stopped, and people are staring at me. Why can't I move my limbs? Why is my head numb? Maybe I'll die here, rooted to the floor, and they'll bronze me as a monument to the unknown student. Take heart. It doesn't have to be like this. Let me give you the first step you need to take in any research project so that you break free from bondage. It's simple. Get a working knowledge of your topic. Right. So what's a working knowledge? Here's a basic definition. You have a working knowledge of a topic when you can talk about it for 1 minute without repeating yourself. To start your research, all you need to do is acquire 1 minute's knowledge. 1 minute, you say? I have been told I have to present a 15-page research paper with a dozen footnotes, including appropriate journal references, whatever they are. Why talk to me about 1 minute of working knowledge? I do so for the same reason that you take a flashlight with you to avoid stumbling around when it's dark. A working knowledge gives you the basics of a topic and enough light so that you won't hurt yourself as you move on into the more complicated territory. It isn't complete knowledge, but it's enough to tell you what the topic entails, what the boundaries are, and even what some of its controversies, mysteries, and dangers might be. So where do you get a working knowledge? One can simply go on the internet, where virtually anything is explained by some site or another. But if you don't know much about the topic to begin with, the net may not be the best source, because it's not easy to judge the reliability of information on a new topic. You would do better to investigate authoritative reference sources first. All academic libraries have recognized reference tools that provide concise and authoritative information on virtually any topic you might think of. Reference books will generally appear in the form of dictionaries or encyclopedias on general or specific topics. As well, handbooks, atlases, in fact, any tool that involves looking at brief information may be found in a reference collection. You would be amazed at how many topic areas have dictionaries or encyclopedias devoted to them, from broader disciplines like psychology or chemistry to narrow ones, as, for example, the Encyclopedia of Christmas. You will find good, brief information on virtually anything you want unless it's a very recent topic. Increasingly, reference sources are also appearing in electronic form, allowing for greater flexibility in searching. But you, or your library, will need to subscribe with real money to the best of these. The best reference sources are not available without cost on the internet, though some older or light versions of reference tools are appearing there for free. Your most useful venue for good reference information is still a library. So if you're in a library and wondering how to find a reference book that will give you information on marriage customs of the Kurdish people, you could wander the shelves of the reference collection, but there is an easier way to find what you want. Think of the broad subject within which your subject lies. In this case, you are looking at customs of a particular culture. Thus, you could look up the subject heading in your library's catalog, like Manners and Customs Encyclopedias, to find a reference source like the World Mark Encyclopedia of Cultures and Daily Life. Then you can just look up Kurds.
Wikipedia, the Professor's Dilemma. A lot of students use Wikipedia, the free online encyclopedia with an awesome range of articles on every conceivable topic. Technically speaking, the Wikipedia phenomenon should have been a disaster from the beginning. Normally, encyclopedias are created by an editor who assigns known experts in their fields to write articles that are then carefully studied for accuracy and clarity. Wikipedia's articles are written by the public, you and me, any Joe or Jane Blow who wants to add an entry. Sure, there are safeguards to help maintain a measure of objectivity and preserve a structure for what is included in a good article. But not only can anyone write an article, most anyone can edit an article too, though changes to certain articles may need to be verified by other users. In fact, the edits that usually stick, without being changed back by one of the volunteer watchdogs that guard articles from being vandalized, are those for which a large number of people agree that the change is needed. Stephen Colbert, the TV satirist, has coined the term wikiality. According to Wikipedia, Colbert defined wikiality as truth by consensus rather than fact, modeled after the approval by consensus format of Wikipedia. Colbert, on one of his shows, called on all of his viewers to test his truth by consensus accusation by changing the entry on African elephants to say that the population of elephants had tripled in the past 6 months, which of course it hadn't. Wikipedia had to restrict editing on African elephant material due to the large number of changes that were made. All kidding aside, is Wikipedia good or bad? Tough question to answer. The information in it is often amazingly reliable, but there are also glaring errors. Many professors have simply opted for the safest road and told their students not to use it. Wikipedia itself tells its readers not to use its articles in research bibliographies. On the other hand, the journal Nature did a study that showed the mistakes in Wikipedia to be only a few more than those in Encyclopedia Britannica. Britannica answered with an angry rebuttal, claiming poor methodology, but Nature has stuck to its original findings. So to use or not to use Wikipedia? I'm more on the side of use with discernment. Since it is an encyclopedia, you would not, in most cases, even consider using it in a research bibliography, since research papers normally don't contain reference book information, which is just background for your own development in a topic, unless the reference article is several pages long. You likely will use it to develop your working knowledge or to plunder the often useful bibliographies at the end of the article, but be careful. Don't rely just on Wikipedia. What you read at any one moment might be a sabotage of an article, to be corrected in a couple of hours, or something that is just wrong and hasn't yet been noticed. Compare what you read in Wikipedia with other traditionally published reference sources.
Finding a good question. Research is not research until you have focused it around a solid research question that addresses a problem or issue. But how do you come up with a question that is going to work? Narrow your topic to one aspect. A big reason why research can fail is that the researcher is trying to conquer the world with one project. You simply cannot cover everything about the topic of teen suicide or abortion or the causes of World War I or why the moon isn't made of green cheese. You have to choose an aspect that is distinct enough that you can really work with it. Otherwise, you end up with a superficial survey because you are trying to cover too much. The broader your focus, the more shallow your paper. You want depth. Avoid questions that survey large amounts of data. The resulting projects will never dwell on any one thing for more than a few lines, and they will have bibliographies that cover a wide variety of issues. Instead of looking at the life of Napoleon, analyze why he lost the Battle of Waterloo. Narrow is good. Big sweeping topics breed ugliness and despair, or at least boredom.
Identify controversies or questions related to your narrowed approach. There is no point re-describing what has already been described, since research is not merely the gathering of information, but the use of information to solve a problem. Information is not an end in itself, but a means to help solve a problem. To tell me the life story of Napoleon or explain the problem of teenage drinking once again is to do what every reference source on the subject has already done. This is where those excruciatingly boring and superficial research papers come from. You must vow never to write another one. Find something worth investigating. In the case of teenage drinking, you might want to consider various types of public service advertising to determine which is most effective in reaching problem drinkers. This could lead to the research question. Which form of public advertising is best able to reach problem teenage drinkers?
Thesis statements. What if, instead of a research question, you have been asked to provide a thesis statement? What's the difference? Research questions and thesis statements are actually like two sides of the same coin. A research question addresses a problem to be solved. A thesis statement is a tentative answer to a research question. It is tentative in that your written research project is going to have to test your thesis and hopefully show it to be correct. Thus, if your research question were, to what extent should the U.S. government have known of the risk of the New York 9/11 disaster before it happened? Your thesis statement could be, there was sufficient warning of a New York 9/11 type disaster before it happened, so the U.S. government should have been well prepared for its occurrence. Or, your thesis might be, despite the signs of a potential terrorist attack, there is no way that the U.S. government could have had sufficient information to be prepared for the New York 9/11 disaster. For either of these possible thesis statements, the onus would be on you to provide the convincing evidence to support your thesis, as well as giving due consideration to contradicting evidence. Thesis statement route does have a tendency to create a bias so that it's tempting to overlook or minimize evidence that does not support your case. Thus, unless you have been told to provide a thesis statement, using a research question is more likely to have you entering the investigation with an open mind.
Research questions, the bad and the ugly. Some research questions simply won't work. They are doomed to failure and will produce research projects that are walking disasters, if they can walk at all. One way to recognize a good question is to know what the bad and ugly ones look like, so here are some examples. 1. The question that isn't there. Imagine the horror of someone reading your research paper and looking desperately but in vain for a question, or even the suggestion of an issue or problem to be addressed, only to discover that there is none. What's the purpose of your paper? The professor muses. To tell me something I could have read in any reference book? To tell me once again what everyone already knows? To put me to sleep with your knowledge of trivia? To punish me for not being your favorite professor? 2. The fuzzy question. Sure, there's a question, but it isn't clear enough to make it possible to answer. Asking something like, why was Saddam Hussein the way he was, is no help at all. What way was he? Are you talking about his role as dictator of Iraq, his use of chemical weapons, his oil strategy, or just what? Until you clarify your focus, you will find no way to answer your question without simply surveying everything the world knows about him, which would likely depress the life out of you. 3. The multi-part question. You must never let more than one research question intrude into a research project. Research identifies one question, deals with that question through analytical use of data, and then quits. Never ever get stuck in the kind of proposal that says, why did the financial meltdown of 2008 and following happen? Should people have foreseen it? Were governmental measures to solve it the right ones to use? How can we prevent future meltdowns? Your second, third, and fourth questions are loose torpedoes on your own ship. They will sink you because they'll kill your focus or at least broaden it to something too big to deal with. One question per research project is all you need or want. 4. The open-ended question. This is often expressed as, what are the implications of, or what were the results of? Thus, encouraging to produce a list of possible outcomes. One-ended questions tend to be troublesome simply because they fragment your conclusion into the many possible answers and thus destroy the goal of the paper to have a single-minded goal. The way to cure this kind of question is to close the end. For example, instead of asking, what were the implications of the end of World War II? You could ask, why did the end of World War II affect the recovery of the French automobile industry as it did? The focus of the implications is now much narrower than it was. 5. The question that will not fly. Some questions are amazingly inventive, but they try to answer questions that the data simply will not answer. Asking, is today's generation smarter than the previous one because it knows how to text message? A real question asked by an undergraduate. May look cool, but exactly how would you gather relevant data to answer it? If your question is ambitious, ask yourself whether or not it's possible to find an answer. If not, curb your enthusiasm. Summary comment. In my experience, the best research questions are simple ones that require a good deal of analysis to answer. If you start with a highly complex question, your analysis is going to have to be that much more complex. The ideal is to have a question so simple and clear that you can actually see the goal before you in your mind's eye and the path you need to take to get there. Yet the answer must require some struggle to come to, and it must be capable of leading you to provide concrete evidence to support it. You use the evidence you gather as a means to discover the solution rather than the solution itself.
The preliminary outline. Chances are, if you're like most people, that you're not in any mood early in any research project to start thinking about an outline for your final product. People who start working on their outline before they've done their first catalog search are either sick or lost souls, because any sensible person knows that you compose your outline after you write your paper. Wrong. If you want to spare yourself a ton of grief, start on a preliminary outline now. Why? Simply because you need to build yourself as clear a roadmap as possible in order to get research done efficiently. And by efficiently, I mean that you will save time. A research question may be crucial to giving your search a goal, but an outline is crucial to tracing the path you need to follow in order to reach that goal. What's a preliminary outline? It's simply 3 to 5 points that you think you'll have to cover if you want to answer the research question. Don't worry, you won't necessarily be bound to the outline. It's preliminary and open to modification. Yet, though your understanding of what points you need may change over time, you need to start on an outline now, even if you modify it later. How do you develop a preliminary outline? Begin with your research question and dig your outline out of terminology in your question. Suppose you have the following question. Was the American belief that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction when the Iraq War of 2003 began based on plausible evidence? The question itself gives clues for a preliminary outline. You need to look at possible evidence that he did have such weapons, evidence that he didn't, and the reasons why the U.S. found the evidence that he did so compelling. Once you have a few basic elements, try to organize them into a rough order. For example, 1. Evidence available at the time that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. 2. Evidence available at the time that he did not have such weapons. 3. Evaluation of the plausibility of the evidence available. And 4. Conclusion. Take note that your preliminary outline is just that, preliminary. You can change it and develop it at will, or even scrap it and create a new one. But you do need to get some sort of outline going as soon as you have a research question, because the outline tells you what you need to cover in order to write the paper that answers your research question.
How about a few good examples? The Thought of Erasmus of Rotterdam. Your much beloved philosophy professor has assigned you The Thought of Erasmus of Rotterdam. Having studied philosophy dictionaries and having taken a peek at Wikipedia, you narrow your topic to the humanism of Erasmus of Rotterdam. You could, at this point, decide to begin your paper with Erasmus of Rotterdam was born in the year ... You could go on to explain what he taught about humanism and then conclude, it's clear that Erasmus was an important thinker in the realm of humanism who deserves much more attention. This method is called regurgitating your sources. It establishes a conduit between your books and your writing hand without ever really engaging your brain. It also makes for a very dull paper. Professors fall asleep over dull papers. On the other hand, you could be analytical. Having read your sources and affixed your working knowledge firmly in your mind, you could engage your brain in finding a research question. How about asking this? What is the essential difference between humanism of Erasmus and that of the modern humanist manifestos 1 and 2. This could certainly demand the study of Erasmus, but it would go further. Now you have the makings of an approach that could contribute something fresh and exciting to the topic. Homelessness in our cities. You are taking a sociology class and you are supposed to write a paper on homelessness in our cities. You could regurgitate some statistics and recite a few case studies and conclude, it is obvious that we need to take action on this issue, Or you might narrow down your topic and ask a research question like this one. Do programs that arrest homeless teens and compel them to accept social worker assistance actually reduce the incidence of teen homelessness in the long run?
The causes of the ecological crisis. For a course on environmental issues, you have been assigned the causes of the ecological crisis. You narrow this to focus on the human values in society that can lead to ecological problems. A descriptive paper which strings together quotations from current leaders in the debate who are decrying our attitudes of wastefulness and greed. Your conclusion could read, "Thus, it is clear that we must change our attitudes." You have narrowed your topic, but you failed to apply a research question to it. An analytical research paper would go further, perhaps considering the role of the U.S. National Dream in the American ecological crisis. Your question could be, to what extent is the national dream of expansion and development to blame for our environmental crisis?
Behaviorism is a model for social engineering. You have been given a topic which is fairly narrow, but still covers a lot of territory. Why not narrow it down to the behaviorist model of B.F. Skinner? You might now take the easy way and summarize his book Walden 2, which is Skinner's model for social engineering. Or you could ask, how would B.F. Skinner revise his model of human living in Walden 2 if darker basic human traits like selfishness and aggressiveness were taken into account? One final note of caution. Always clear your narrowed down topic and brilliant research question with your professor or supervisor. Disaster could be awaiting if you don't. Of course, some of us like to flirt with disaster. Do you feel lucky?